Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Keeping score of the European debt crisis, or trying to. The not-so-fine print in credit card contracts. And for us, a new partnership with Gallup on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for the 7th of December. Good to have you with us. And if this is a Wednesday, which it is, must be time for an update on the European debt crisis. There was some news around the edges of the negotiations over how to finally figure out an answer to this thing. But the real story took a break today, to be picked up tomorrow and Friday with that big meeting and the new European Union treaty that Germany and France are pushing. So while we wait, we asked our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, to do a little prep work, a scorecard, if you will, of the sticking points and possible solutions.
This time, French officials are vowing to keep bargaining until they reach what they call a powerful deal they can show the world. This has a familiar ring. Mark Chandler is global head of currency strategy at Brown Brothers Harriman.
This summit is, I believe, the fifth one since the middle of 2010 that the Europeans have billed as a comprehensive do-or-die moment, so to speak.
Chandler thinks an agreement can be reached, but he concedes finding unanimous accord among all 27 members of the European Union is unlikely. German officials say they'll be satisfied if they get the support of just the 17 countries that use the euro. Even just a concerted message from the major players could be enough to persuade skittish lenders, according to Douglas Elliott at the Brookings Institution.
If you get Chancellor Merkel and President Sarkozy and President Draghi of the European Central Bank to step forward and make clear they're putting their political weight behind it, I think the markets will see that this is serious.
The question is, will the weaker nations agree to the dictates of the stronger ones? There's still a lot of hand-wringing over proposed rules that would limit the deficits of euro nations to 3% of their gross domestic product. Elliott says the deeply indebted countries have no choice.
What is the phrase? Something like, he who pays the piper makes the rules?
And Mark Chandler says Germany is doing what any prudent investor would do when asked for a bailout by a poor relation.
It's sort of like if my sister asked me for money. I of course, would give her the money, but I'd want to, like, help her if she's, like, a chronic debtor and work out a repayment schedule. I'd want to make sure she's not going to just take that money and go to Las Vegas with it.
Chandler says he's hopeful Europe's debtor nations will accept the terms because the alternative, he says, seems so dreadful. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
There could be a vote in the United States Senate tomorrow on the fate of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or of who's going to run it, more accurately. The White House wants the Senate to confirm former Ohio Attorney General Richard Cordray to the job. Republicans have said they'll block any one person that's named to run the place. They want a committee of five to do that. But there are some things the CFPB is doing in the meanwhile. Today, the Bureau unveiled a prototype for a new standardized credit card agreement in plain, actual English. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that story.
I would rather eat dirt than read my credit card agreement. It took this assignment and a strong suggestion from my editor for me to find it online, print it out, and read it, starting with the rules on rates for cash advances. All right. 19.24% for elite and premium pricing, or 23.24% for standard pricing. I don't get that. There was a lot I didn't get, so I wasn't surprised to hear the CFPB say that two-thirds of cardholders don't understand the terms of their credit cards because of the way they're written. Raj Date, the Treasury official who's temporarily running the CFPB, says the prototype is only two pages.
We've taken away the fine print and legalese, and we've reordered the most important information so that it's easy for consumers to see.
The CFPB is asking banks for input, but they aren't required to use the new form. Elise Brooks is with the Financial Services Roundtable.
Those, obviously, this is a new proposal. We'll have to drill down into the details.
Details like whether a standardized contract would limit a bank's financial offerings or increase the risk of lawsuits.
Hi, Vesmer.
Ira Reingold heads the National Association of Consumer Advocates. He says banks will complain about the standardized agreement because it'll be easier to compare credit cards, but eventually they'll adopt it.
That once this becomes sort of standard fare, the credit card company that chooses not to use this type of contract will be looked on with disfavor by a lot of consumers.
But you'll only benefit from a standardized agreement if you actually read it. Reingold says the prototype agreement is designed for the educated consumer who likes to shop around. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Let's say you've lost your job in the past 3 years or so, and you went on unemployment. Once your state benefits ran out, extended federal benefits probably kicked in. In states with high jobless rates, you might have been getting benefits for as long as 99 weeks. But if Congress lets that program expire, and they are debating that right now, it's not just the unemployed who are going to notice. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has the story.
So, what do the unemployed spend their unemployment checks on? I stopped in at my local employment office in Portland, Oregon to find out.
Rent and my bills, basic necessities.
Rent, utilities, groceries.
Holly Primiano and Shalene Macon are an unemployed retail manager and teacher, respectively. They've each been getting a weekly unemployment check around $400, care of the federal government. And most of the time, there's nothing left over.
People who are receiving a unemployment check, if you give them a dollar, they will spend that dollar, and that will ripple through the economy quite a bit.
That's economist Chris Christopher at IHS Global Insight. He says take away the $44 billion in federal unemployment checks next year, and it's not just the long-term unemployed who'd feel the pain. It's the places they tend to shop, too. Ken Perkins is with Retail Metrics.
Dollar General, which is one of the major chains in the space, Family Dollar, 99-cent stores have all been expanding. So this is one of the few areas where there is significant growth.
Dollar General announced it'll open more than 600 new stores next year. Perkins says that growth could slow significantly if federal unemployment benefits go away. Back at the unemployment office in Portland, former retail manager Holly Primiano has been scrimping and saving.
I've been trying to, if there's any extra money, to put money aside for when unemployment runs off.
6 million Americans would run out of benefits next year if federal funding isn't extended. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the usual European-induced gyrations. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We come now to the portion of today's program in which we ask a not entirely hypothetical question. Can two companies who've seen better days come to each other's mutual aid? JCPenney and Martha Stewart most certainly hope so. Penney said today it's going to spend about $38 million to buy a stake in Martha Stewart Living Omnimedia. Both of those companies have been struggling quite a bit, so they've come up with an idea to have small Martha Stewart shops within larger JCPenney stores. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler gauges the odds of success.
In a little over a year, JCPenney will unveil a new store within its stores. Martha Stewart says it's something different for her brand.
I have long wanted to have my own freestanding stores, and I'm going to be able to do that within JCPenney.
This is hardly Stewart's first foray into retail partnerships. You may remember this from the 80s.
I'm Martha Stewart, and I'm Kmart's new consultant for entertaining and lifestyle.
She had an exclusive deal with Kmart for a long time, and that's limiting when you have just one retailer you're doing business with.
George Whalen is president of Retail Management Consultants.
I think it's good for both companies.
JCPenney gets a big-name brand to lure shoppers, but the deal won't be exclusive.
The new Martha Stewart collection, only at Macy's.
Stewart has deals with Macy's, Home Depot, and PetSmart. She doesn't see a conflict.
This will be different merchandise. It will not be the same design. Louis Vuitton is at Macy's, but it's also at Saks. It's also on Madison Avenue. It's also on Fifth Avenue.
It's not the products that concern some experts. It's the business deal. Michael Levy is professor of marketing at Babson College.
I think having an exclusive private label will benefit JCPenney's. I don't understand why it had to be an ownership position.
He says Penny could have set up the Stewart shops without investing directly in her struggling company. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
We're We're well clear of official hurricane season, but New York area commuters are still recovering from Tropical Storm Irene, which hit more than 3 months ago. The storm washed away miles of train track north of the city, and it's being rebuilt, of course, at no small cost, but with a climate change premium added on. Andrea Bernstein reports now from the Transportation Nation Project at WNYC.
It's been a busy fall for construction workers on the Port Jervis commuter rail line. The track takes passengers from New York City to points north and west. On August 27th, Tropical Storm Irene roared through, adding buckets of rain to what had already been the wettest August on record. 14 miles of the Port Jervis line were washed out.
In over 28 and a half years, I have not ever seen anything to this magnitude on any of our lines.
Fred Chittister manages the Port Jervis line for the Metropolitan Transportation Authority. Irene twisted the tracks like chewing gum and left waves of mangled steel.
And the type of damage that was done is just unthinkable.
Fixing the tracks is costing $30 million. Part of that cost, about 10%, comes from special fortifications and drainage pipes that can handle future onslaughts of water. Chittister says his agency had no choice but to eat the added cost.
Our 100-year storms seem to be happening every 3 years now.
Extreme weather has been adding costs to transit projects across the country. Last year, Nashville had to replace dozens of its city buses after its main depot flooded. Washington, D.C. and Boston had to swap out train tracks buckled by extreme heat. The Federal Transit Administration is advising transit agencies to get ready for more rain, more snow, more heat.
And to not address it would be a naive response to the fact that there's millions of dollars on the ground.
Therese McMillan is deputy FTA administrator. She says transit agencies need to invest in shoring up vital transportation networks now or pay a higher price later.
So whatever arguments folks want to have about the sources of the impacts, we're seeing impacts.
But adapting to climate change can mean a trade-off for transit agencies. The more money you spend reinforcing infrastructure, the less you have to transport the public. Take New York's MTA. On the one hand, the agency faces a $10 billion gap in its capital budget. It's had to cut train and bus service to make ends meet. At the same time, it's having to spend millions on adaptation projects like raising street vents so subway lines don't flood. Prajal Dutta is in charge of the MTA's climate adaptation planning. He says, for the planet's sake, now is no time to be cutting measures to get people out of their cars.
If there were more public transportation, there would be less greenhouse gas emissions. It is ironical, therefore, that in order to fight this greenhouse gas problem, resources have to be diverted from the regular running of a system. That's a real tragedy.
But even advocates of public transportation concede the MTA has to divert resources to adaptation projects. New York's economy generates $4 billion a day. If the city's transportation system stops, so does the economy. Columbia University scientist Klaus Jacob says intense storms coupled with sea level rise could put the subway system underwater by the end of this century.
There will be a bitter awakening what climate change really will cost.
Unless, he says, transit officials agree to spend billions in the short run. In New York, I'm Andrea Bernstein for Marketplace.
Coming up, daily deals and donations.
I mean, everybody's on Groupon, and one out of 10 is clicking on that button. You know, that's a lot of money raised.
But first, let's do the numbers. Optimism is in the air. At least that's how investors felt today about Europe's debt crisis. Dow Industrials increased 46 points, up nearly 0.4%, ended things at 12,196. The Nasdaq lost just a fraction of 1%, less than a point, 2649. The S&P 500 added 2 points, 0.2%, closed at 1261. Financial stocks led the market. Where have you heard me say that before? Morgan Stanley deposited more than 4.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase jumped up 2%. B of A, Bank of America, banked up nearly 2% today. Retail stocks also up. The Men's Warehouse stitched up 19%. The retailer reported third quarter earnings that topped expectations. On the other side of the shopping aisle, women's clothing company Talbot raised its hem by almost 70% with news that a private equity company has made a takeover bid. The news we told you about JCPenney and Martha Stewart, win-win. JCPenney polished up 0.6%. Martha Stewart, Living Omnimedia, gained 33%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on wholesale inventories and sales for the month of October. The Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions discusses tales from the unemployment line, barriers facing the long-term unemployed. And a look at the food pyramid throughout the ages. The National Archives discusses the history and future of the USDA dietary recommendations. Just in time for the holidays, right? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Iowa caucuses are less than a month away, believe it or not, which means we're going to be hearing this from politicians a whole lot more. Something along the lines of, the American people want, and then whatever issue is top of mind. But what do Americans really want? We're going to tell you straight from the source. Today we launch a new partnership with Gallup, weekly conversations about what the American people think about everything from the latest news to their own economic security in a segment we're calling Attitude Check. The question du jour, keying off the negotiations about how to pay for the payroll tax cut and the general conversation that started about economic inequality in this country, is who exactly is rich? Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup. Frank, it's good to talk to you.
Good to be with you.
So this question of who is rich, it has to be one of those kind of depends answers, right?
Oh, absolutely. It depends on how rich you are when you answer the question. We've asked this several times, and we basically ask Americans, how much money would you need annual income, that is, to consider yourself rich? Separate question, we say, how much net worth would you need to consider yourself to be rich?
Right.
And overall right now, the median is $200,000. For the average American out there across this country, if you have $200,000 annual income, you're rich, and $1 million is the net worth figure.
Is there anything in here about the inequality factor? I mean, we've been hearing a lot about Occupy Wall Street and We Are the 99%. What do your numbers show about inequality and how important that is to a lot of people?
Boy, that's a great question. And this comes up periodically, Kai, and is not new. I was just reviewing a book by Kevin Phillips the other day that he wrote in 1990. The title was The Politics of the Rich and the Poor. And he was going on about how Americans were going to be upset about the concentration of wealth in that upper 1%. You know, that was 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So this is not a new phenomenon. But what we're finding trend-wise, and I think this is a really key point, is we're finding no more on a lot of our measures of interest in reducing this gap between the rich and the poor than we have found previously.
Say that again. That's important. There's not a huge interest in reducing the wealth gap.
Well, I'm saying there is not an increased interest now compared to what we have seen previously. It is true that Americans, and this is one of those verities in polling in our data consistently, say, sure, tax the rich. As we just talked about, most Americans themselves don't think they're rich, so it's fine with them to tax the rich. But we don't see in our data that there's a hugely increased push for the government, for policymakers, to really focus on reducing the gap between the wealthy and the not wealthy, as opposed to simply growing the economy.
So let me ask you the question, the answer to which is probably not in your data, and it goes like this. How come that interest is not increasing?
Well, that is a good question. And I don't think that the answer is in our data, but we have a lot of negativity towards the federal government in general. And why I mention that is because if one talks about, and to some degree President Obama talked about this, of course, in his speech in Kansas, If one talks about trying to address this inequality and give everybody, and he used these words, a fair share,
right,
somebody has to do that. And that's the federal government. And all of our data shows that Americans are really leery of the federal government getting involved in a big way in doing anything. So I think that's part of the issue. If you're going to have increased equality, how do you bring it about? If it's the government, Americans are hesitant.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief of Gallup. You can read more about the great data they've got and our partnership with them on our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on the link that says Attitude Check. Frank, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you next week.
My pleasure.
Our series on philanthropy continues today, the whys and hows behind our giving. Coming up, we're going to hear how Daily Deal companies, think Groupon and Living Social, are getting into the charity business. But first, we're going to go small, really small. The philanthropic buzzword you hear a lot right now is microgrants, turning a tiny amount of giving into something big. Commentator Jennifer Ait Lee has some experience with that.
What could be more awesome than spreading awesomeness? The Awesome Foundation's mission is to increase awesomeness in the universe one microgrant at a time. It's ordinary people giving ordinary amounts of money to make extraordinary things happen. Here's how it works. Every month, a group of 10 or so people get together and give $100 each to create a $1,000 grant that they give out to something that they think is an awesome idea. This kind of microphilanthropy has helped fund a giant hammock in Boston Commons, swings across Los Angeles, rooftop bees in Melbourne, and a map of kisses in Toronto. The Awesome Foundation started in 2009 in Boston, but has grown to 29 chapters on four continents and cities like Calgary, Melbourne, and Berlin. When Awesome Pittsburgh was launched, the city of Pittsburgh declared October 18th Awesome Pittsburgh Day. How awesome is that? I helped start Awesome Food, which funds awesome food-related ideas around the world. So far, one of the projects we funded is Urban Jungle, a group in Atlanta that picks fruit from trees in abandoned lots, washes them, and gives them to homeless shelters. Now ask yourself, wouldn't it be awesome if, and fill in that blank, that's your Awesome Foundation proposal? Or if the answer is, wouldn't it be awesome if there were an Awesome Foundation chapter where I live? Find nine or so friends. You too can further awesomeness in the universe.
Jennifer Ait Lee is a journalist and the author of the book, The Fortune Cookie Chronicle. Send us your comments. Cookies, too, would be nice. Marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. All right, so here's another view of charity from the repeat giver's point of view.
My name is Cara Gafford. I'm a chef and culinary instructor. We do give every year. I do try to choose organizations that are in our community, because I think that that's one of those things that ties us back to our communities. Obviously, in a down economy, we can't rely on the people who don't have work to give back, so the people who do have work have some sort of responsibility. Our giving tends to be percentage-based. So if you have less, then you have less of a responsibility. I don't turn to somebody who has very little and say, well, why aren't you giving more?
That was Cara Gafford from Houston, Texas. She came to us through our Public Insight Network. And now a moment for the getters of charity and a new twist on a time-honored fundraising tactic. Sally Herships reports.
To witness the latest fusion of modern fundraising techniques and technology at work, I've come to see PS222. It's not a new computer or a social network. It's an elementary school in Brooklyn where a visiting student band is about to perform. Candace Pohl is the band teacher, and she says charity is at work across the stage. The tenor sax, two trumpets in the back row, and the red drum set all came from donations. So do a lot of her students' basic supplies.
The students get books, they receive pencils, they receive paper, and once that supply is done, you just cross your fingers and hope that they reappear next year sometimes.
But since the recession, donations to the nonprofit group that Pohl works with, a website called Donors Choose, have been shrinking. So the charity has been doing something new, teaming up with Groupon, the Daily Deal site, to reinvent a fundraising classic, the match. A corporate donor doubles whatever private donations are made. Other charities are also offering donation deals through sites like Groupon, Bloomspot, and Living Social.
Because, you know, it's kind of like a sale. You're stretching your dollar, especially in this economy. If you think you can give $5 and it's really worth $10, you know, people love it. How can you not?
Heather Wallace is Senior Director of Marketing for City Harvest in New York. It supplies food pantries with surplus food from restaurants and supermarkets. Wallace says working with a national Daily Deal site with a huge mailing list can give small charities access to an enormous audience of potential donors.
I mean, everybody's on Groupon, and one out of 10 is clicking on that button. You know, that's a lot of money raised.
And a lot of money saved. Charities don't have to invest in finding new donors, so says Stacey Palmer, editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. It's a win-win.
Charities get better at doing social media. The corporations get the brownie points for having supported a good cause.
The Daily Deal offer is working for Donors Choose, the nonprofit that raises money for school supplies. Donors Choose has gotten almost 4,500 donations through Groupon. That's just since last week when Groupon ran its latest offer. And a third came from new donors. Chase Bank, the corporate sponsor, has given $4 for every dollar raised. Even Groupon is chipping in. It's waiving the cut it normally takes for commercial daily deals and paying the credit card fees itself. In Brooklyn, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk of, I don't think you quite understand. JPMorgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon was speaking at a financial industry conference today, organized for what it's worth by Goldman Sachs. And he was asked about banks and how everybody seems to be mad at them nowadays. Here's what he said.
I mean, acting like everyone who's been successful is bad and that you're, because you're rich, you're bad. I don't understand it. I don't get it.
So there you go. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow added 46 points, up nearly 0.4%. The NASDAQ lost less than a point, a fraction of a percent. The S&P 500 added 2 points, 0.2%. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the broadcast for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time, back here.
The gap between the 1% and 99% is far too great. And part of the reason is we've not done the job and education needs to be done.
Billionaire giver Eli Broad as our philanthropy series continues. I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.